mission has no other object than to discover the Pacific Ocean, following the Missouri, and to make intelligent observations, because he has the reputation of being a very well-educated man and of many talents. Built on a bluff above the floodplain, St. Louis, when Lewis arrived, was 4 decades old, with a population of a little over 1,000, mainly French Canadians. For so young and so small a town, St. Louis had a critical role to play in a vast empire. It was the center of the fur trade for the huge region drained by the Missouri. Most of the trade goods came from across the ocean, then crossed the continent to reach St. Louis. From that central point, the goods fanned out via individual traders to the farthest reaches of the frontier. And the pirogues and keelboats that carried the trade goods to the Indians brought back stacks and stacks of beautiful furs that brought kings ransoms in Europe. Business opportunities abounded, in short, and continued to expand because of the American pioneers slipping across to the Spanish side and making farms on the pieces of ground they had cleared. When the formal transfer of Louisiana from Spain to France and then to the United States took place, expected sometime in the coming spring, Americans would be rushing into the Missouri country. They would need outfitting. As if things weren't good enough for the St. Louis merchants, here came Meriwether Lewis, with only enough supplies in hand for a party of 15, instead of the amount needed for a party of 45, and armed with an authorization from the president to buy whatever he might need and charge it to the army. The merchants of the day had suddenly become the first military contractors in St. Louis. In addition to supplies, Lewis was going to need men, voyagers with strong backs who could paddle the pirogues up the Missouri to the Mandan villages. He would be spending a lot of time in the town, haggling with merchants, sizing up volunteers. Before Lewis left Washington, Jefferson had given him oral instructions to gather as much statistical information as possible on Upper Louisiana, which meant another job to do in St. Louis. At the time he arrived in St. Louis, Lewis had not yet received Jefferson's direct orders to abandon his risky plan to ride to Santa Fe during the winter months, but he had put the foolish thought out of his mind anyway. His problem was going to be finding enough time to do all that needed to be done, not how to pass time. First came winter camp. On December 9th, Lewis crossed to the Illinois side and met Clark and the party at Cahokia. He reported that the Spanish would not allow a movement up the Missouri, but Jarrett had a claim to a 400-acre tract at the mouth of Wood River and suggested Lewis would find it a good place to build huts for the winter, to get started on modifying the keelboat for the long haul up the Missouri, and to select and train the men for the permanent party. Clark went on to the site to look it over. Lewis returned to St. Louis to get going on his tasks. He began by doing his research on Upper Louisiana. It was the first survey done by an American of any part of the purchase. Lewis worked up a questionnaire with such queries as the population, the number of immigrants from the United States into Louisiana, how much land had been granted to individuals, the value of the imports and exports to and from St. Louis, and so on. Then he set out to talk to the men in town who had some knowledge of the local and regional situation. He turned first to Antoine Soulard, Surveyor General of Upper Louisiana for the Spanish government. Soulard, a Frenchman, told Lewis that the 1800 census recorded a population of about 10,000 in Upper Louisiana, 2,000 of whom were slaves. About two-thirds of the whites were Americans. That was 3 years ago. In 1803 alone, it was estimated that another 100 American families had crossed over into Upper Louisiana. Scouts from North Carolina and elsewhere had come to look over the Missouri country in search of some eligible positions to form settlements as soon as the American government is in operation. In reporting these and other matters to Jefferson, Lewis referred to an idea Jefferson had often expressed to him, that the American pioneers in Upper Louisiana could be persuaded to accept land in Illinois in exchange for their holdings. It was Jefferson's notion that the land west of the Mississippi could be turned into a vast Indian reservation, where the Indians could learn to farm and become good citizens. That way, there could be an orderly progression of the frontier, across Ohio and Indiana and on to Illinois, and a frontier free from Indian troubles, since all the Indians would be removed to the far shore. This absurd notion showed how little Jefferson knew about Americans living west of the Appalachians. With the purchase, or even without the purchase, there was no force on earth that could stop the flow of American pioneers westward. Good, cheap land was a magnet that reached all the way back to Europe. The pioneers were the cutting edge of an irresistible force. Rough and wild though they were the advance agents of millions of Europeans, mostly peasants or younger sons of small farmers, who constituted the greatest mass migration in history. When Lewis and Clark arrived on the Mississippi River, they were following the first American settlers in Missouri and were but a jump ahead of thousands of others who were thinking about or already on their way to Missouri. Napoleon had gotten it right. He might as well sell and get some money for the place because the Americans were going to overrun it anyway. Lewis must have known that the government couldn't get the pioneers to abandon the land they had cleared and cultivated, yet he wrote Jefferson, "I am fully persuaded that your wishes to withdraw the inhabitants of Louisiana may in every necessary degree be effected in the course of a few years." With a bit more realism, he added that the slaveholders might cause trouble. They would not want to cross into the free territory of Illinois. Lewis also did research for his tour. Soulard gave him a map that traced the Missouri to the mouth of the Osage River. Lewis got two other maps, one a general map of Upper Louisiana, and another, the so-called McKay map, made by Scottish trader and explorer James McKay, which Lewis sent Jefferson. In 1795, McKay had gone as far up the Missouri as the village of the Omahas, and the following year he had sent a young assistant, John Evans, on a mission to the Pacific. Evans got no farther than the Mandan villages, but at least that gave McKay the information he needed to extend his map of the Missouri as far up as the Mandans. McKay was living in St. Louis in 1803, and Lewis had profitable talks with him. As historian Roy Appleman puts it, from McKay and the maps Lewis had available to him, Lewis knew virtually everything that was known to white men of the Missouri country as far as the Mandan villages and some Indian information about the lands to their west. The most powerful and prominent St. Louis citizens were the French fur traders Auguste Chouteau, Sr., a founder of the city, his half-brother Pierre Chouteau, Sr., and their brother-in-law Charles Gratiot, who had established the first trading post at Cahokia in 1777. Gratiot had helped supply George Rogers Clark during the Revolution. William Clark had stayed at Gratiot's house during a September 1797 business trip to St. Louis, where he also hobnobbed with Auguste Chouteau and all the fine girls and buckish gentlemen. The Chouteaus had prospered in St. Louis, thanks to a license that gave them exclusive rights on trade, but much of their wealth was in land, taken in payment for goods. Their need was the need of those on the frontier everywhere. Fluid capital, long-term credit, and cash. Money was so scarce in St. Louis that beaver skins were the coin of the land. The Chouteaus had a nice setup. A monopoly, in fact, of every imported item needed, and many of those desired on the frontier, from nails to glass beads, from ironwork to ladies' dresses, from powder and lead to imported wine. But it was too good to last. In 1798, Manuel Lisa arrived in St. Louis and began to muscle his way into the fur trade. He was as quick and sharp as the Chouteaus, having grown up in New Orleans, where he had hustled a living on the teeming waterfront. He moved upstream to St. Louis, where as a Spaniard he got preferential treatment, including some generous land grants. But he had no intention of becoming a farmer. He could see that the real opportunity in St. Louis was in trade. He began agitating for economic liberty. His biographer, Richard Oglesby, says his attack on monopolies made him sound as if he was one of Adam Smith's most ardent disciples. To shut him up, the Spanish gave him a license to trade. From these merchants, Lewis began making his purchases. Corn, flour, biscuits, barrels of salt, kegs of pork, boxes of candles, kegs of hog's lard, 600 pounds grease, 21 bales of Indian goods, tools of every description. He bought from the Chouteaus, he bought from Lisa. He asked questions and got more information for Jefferson. He studied his maps. On December 16th, Driard reported in. He had brought the 8 soldiers from Tennessee with him. Delighted, Lewis quickly examined them. Disappointed, he wrote Clark he found them not possessed of more of the requisite qualifications. There is not a hunter among them. Still, there were possibilities. One of the soldiers was a blacksmith, and another was a house joiner. Lewis sent them on to Clark at Wood River. Eventually, four of the eight passed muster. Through the winter, Lewis kept up an active correspondence with Jefferson. Many letters recorded by Jefferson as received from Lewis, and many letters Jefferson wrote and noted, are missing. Still, what is available is informative and suggestive. On January 13, 1804, Jefferson wrote Lewis, saying he had been able to follow Lewis's progress by newspaper accounts. He reported that the transfer of Louisiana to the United States had been scheduled for December 20th, and he had no doubt it had occurred. The acquisition of the country through which you are to pass has inspired the public generally with a great deal of interest in your enterprise, Jefferson wrote. The inquiries are perpetual as to your progress. The feds alone still treat it as philosophism and would rejoice in its failure. Their bitterness increases with the diminution of their numbers and despair of a resurrection. I hope you will take care of yourself and be the living witness of their malice and folly. To put it another way, those misguided Federalists who had criticized the purchase and derided the expedition were committing political suicide, so the President's aide need not worry about pleasing them by making a ride to Santa Fe. Avoiding unnecessary risks was the way Lewis could confound the feds. On January 22nd, Jefferson wrote Lewis to confirm that the transfer had happened in New Orleans on December 20th, and to give him instructions on how to deal with the Indians now that the United States was sovereign throughout Louisiana. The instructions came down to, "Tell them they have a new father." Jefferson also wanted Lewis to offer the Osage chief a free trip to Washington to meet the new father, and to be impressed by the power and numbers of the Americans. Jefferson closed with the welcome news that the American Philosophical Society had elected Lewis to membership. He had earned it. 2 years of study under Thomas Jefferson, followed by his crash course in Philadelphia, had made Lewis into exactly what Jefferson had hoped for in an explorer. A botanist with a good sense of what was known and what was unknown, a working vocabulary for description of flora and fauna, a map maker who could use celestial instruments properly, a scientist with keen powers of observation, all combined in a woodsman and an officer who could lead a party to the Pacific. Now the payoff for the American Philosophical Society savants began. In March, and again in May, Lewis sent boxes of specimens to Jefferson. They constituted the first shipment of natural history specimens by Lewis to Jefferson from west of the Mississippi, and thus the first ever. He included slips or cuttings from trees owned by Pierre Chouteau, who had gotten them from the Osage Indian village 300 miles to the west. Lewis wrote three long paragraphs of detailed description. As a man of the Enlightenment, now officially signified by his membership in the APS, Lewis was interested in practical uses of the tree, which he named the Osage apple, now the Osage orange. The fruit was never eaten, but the wood was perfect for making bows. So much do the savages esteem the wood of this tree for the purpose of making their bows that they travel many hundred miles in quest of it. That was Lewis's first description of a plant unknown to science. He could anticipate making many more. There are trees growing in Philadelphia at 4th and Spruce Streets and the University of Virginia at Moriah, a guest house, today that grew from the cuttings Lewis sent. And as historian Michael Broadhead notes, this was the beginning of a rich, almost uniquely American phenomenon, the military naturalist. Among Lewis's worries that winter was Clark's commission. Clark had been on active service since the previous summer, but by February 1804, his commission had still not arrived. On February 10th, Lewis wrote Dearborn and Jefferson about the matter. Through to the end of April, he got no reply, nor did the commission arrive in the meantime. The matter continued to nag. The missing commission had no practical effect. Lewis called Clark captain, and their relationship was one of a genuine joint command. Indeed, through the second part of December and all of January, Clark was the officer with the troops in the field. He planned and oversaw the construction of the huts. He made a number of improvements to the keelboat, including some cleverly devised lockers running along the sides of the boat, with lids that could be raised to form a breastwork or shield. When the lids were down, they provided catwalks or passe-avants for men with poles pushing the boat. Crosswise between the lockers, Clark had 11 benches built, each 3 feet long for use by two oarsmen. He added center poles to support an awning. Clark worried about the Indians. The word among the Americans living near the mouth of the Missouri was that upriver the Sioux were hostile, numerous, well-armed, and certain to demand a ransom for passage. Clark added a bronze cannon, probably purchased by Lewis in St. Louis. Mounted on a swivel that allowed it to be turned and fired in any direction, it was the expedition's heaviest armament and in 1804 would be the largest weapon to that date ever taken up the Missouri. It could fire a solid lead ball weighing about 1 pound, or 16 musket balls with sufficient velocity to go through a man. At close range, a highly effective anti-personnel weapon. In addition to the swivel cannon, Clark asked Lewis to get 4 smaller weapons called blunderbusses, heavy shotguns that used buckshot. Lewis found them in St. Louis. Clark mounted them on swivels, 2 for the stern of the keelboat and 1 on each pirogue. They could be loaded with musket balls, scrap iron, or buckshot. At close range, devastating. In early February, Lewis crossed over to the camp at Wood River. He looked over the men, there were nearly 40 of them, and listened as Clark explained what he had done to the keelboat. Clark then left to spend a few days in St. Louis to make purchases and to attend a ball at the Chouteaus. Lewis had intended to join him at the ball, but was obliged to stay in camp to meet with some visiting Kickapoo Indians. Having missed the ball, he wrote Clark, "and finding more to do when I began to look about me than I had previously thought of, I determined it would be as well to go to work here at Wood River and postpone my return to St. Louis a few days." He wanted Clark to talk to Pierre Chouteau about the possibility of his leading an expedition of Osage chiefs to Washington. Clark's tasks in St. Louis included picking a crew of voyagers to paddle the canoes, the captains by now having decided to keep the permanent detachment, the Corps of Discovery, together as a unit on the keelboat. Clark, who had once descended the Mississippi to Memphis and who had lived on the Ohio River for many years, was the better waterman of the two captains, and thus probably the better judge of the voyagers. Clark talked to Manuel Lisa, who was ready to contract out a crew that he would select and organize. Lewis wrote Clark, "Engage them immediately if you think from their appearance and characters they will answer the purpose." Lisa was doing quite a lot of business with the expedition. He paid a visit to Wood River to see what the captains didn't have that he did. Lewis dined in his home, although he most often stayed with Auguste Chouteau in the finest house in town. On February 20th, Lewis prepared to shove off for St. Louis. He issued his first detachment orders, putting Sergeant John Ordway in command during his and Clark's absence, and directing the sawyers to continue their work, the blacksmiths to continue their work, with an extra gill or 4 ounces of whiskey and exemption from guard duty, the men making sugar to continue to do so, and so forth. To save powder and lead, he ordered only 1 round per man per day for target practice. Sergeant Ordway would give instructions in shooting offhand at a distance of 50 yards. There was a prize of an extra gill of whiskey for the winner each day. Except for hunters, no man was to absent himself from camp without Sergeant Ordway's knowledge and permission. Finally, no whiskey beyond the legal ration. Lewis went off to St. Louis, conducted business, and returned a week later. Sergeant Ordway reported to him that Privates Reuben Field and John Shields had refused to mount guard duty as ordered because they would be damned if they would take orders from anyone other than the captains. Privates John Coulter, John Boley, Peter Weiser, and John Robinson had gone off hunting, or so they had told Ordway, who had tried to stop them. In fact, they went to a neighboring whiskey shop on the edge of the nearby American settlement and got drunk. To deal with these disciplinary matters, Lewis wrote another detachment order, dated March 3rd in the journal. "The commanding officer feels himself mortified and disappointed at the disorderly conduct of Field and Shields, especially since he had thought of them as excellent soldiers and men of judgment." He went on, "A moment's reflection must convince every man of our party that the captains had to be in St. Louis to gather the necessary supplies and equipment for the voyage. When they were gone, Sergeant Ordway was in command. Period." Lewis confined Coulter, Boley, Weiser, and Robinson to quarters for 10 days. On March 7th, Lewis returned to St. Louis to be present at the ceremonies marking the formal transfer of Upper Louisiana to the United States. Captain Stoddard, the official American representative, invited Lewis to serve as the chief official witness. There was a detachment from the 1st Infantry Regiment out of Fort Kaskaskia on hand. The ceremony took place on March 9th in front of Government House, Spanish headquarters in the city. First, a transfer was made from Spain to France. Colonel de Lassus presided for Spain, while Stoddard acted as agent for the French. When the Spanish flag was struck, de Lassus presented it to Stoddard, who then ran up the French tricolor. The crowd, composed of nearly all the residents of St. Louis, most of them French, cheered. With tears in their eyes, Frenchmen asked Stoddard to let the tricolor wave over St. Louis for one night. Stoddard agreed. The next day, to the salute of guns and cheers from the soldiers, the tricolor was lowered and the Stars and Stripes was raised, the documents were signed, and appropriate speeches were made. Stoddard assumed the post of military civil governor of Upper Louisiana, pending the establishment of territorial government. After the ceremonies, Lewis and Clark accompanied Stoddard on an inspection of Spanish defenses. A few days later, Clark returned to Wood River to continue preparations. The days were getting noticeably longer, the first hints of opening buds were on the tree limbs, the great duck and geese migrations were just starting, the ice no longer ran in the river, spring was coming. And with the first warm days came an ominously unwelcome visitor. On March 25th, Clark wrote in his journal, "The mosquitoes are very bad this evening." On March 28th, Lewis drew 3 drafts or checks of $500 each on the Secretary of War. He had already drawn $1,669 and drew an additional $159 a few days later. He was also drawing money to provide for the Osage Chief and Pierre Chouteau on their trip to Washington. And he was signing chits for supplies. Altogether, signing his name to a draft on the government was becoming a commonplace experience for Lewis. Indeed, it was threatening to become habit-forming. On the afternoon of the 29th, Lewis crossed over to Wood River. Clark had alarming news. There had been fights between the men. John Shields had opposed an order and had threatened Sergeant Ordway's life and wished to return to Kentucky. John Coulter had disobeyed orders and had loaded his gun, threatening to shoot Ordway. The men had been at Wood River for the better part of 4 months. They never got to go to St. Louis. The only women they saw were the pioneers at the nearby settlements, and there weren't many of them, and mostly they were married. There was a whiskey cellar around, but he was expensive and hard to get to. Once the huts were completed and the keelboat's alterations were finished, the men had almost nothing to do. A little drilling on the parade ground, which they hated, a little target practice, which they loved but only got to do once a day, was about it. These young heroes were in great shape, strong as bulls, eager to get going, full of energy and testosterone, and bored. So they fought and drank and fought. Clark recorded various serious fistfights, sometimes with delightful comment. "Our field was in a mistake and repents. Frazier has done bad." But fighting among themselves was one thing, threatening the sergeant quite another. On March 29th, the captains put Shields and Coulter on trial for mutiny. The privates asked the forgiveness, etc., and promised to do better in future. The captains relented. No punishment was noted. And 2 days later, Shields and Coulter were welcomed into the permanent party. On March 31st, after a full exchange of views between themselves, the captains held a ceremony in order to enlist the 25 men they had selected to be members of the detachment destined for the expedition through the interior of the continent of North America. Another group of 5 soldiers was designated to accompany the expedition to its winter quarters, then to return to St. Louis with communiques and specimens. Corporal Richard Warfington would be its leader. The main detachment was divided into 3 squads. Charles Floyd and Nathaniel Pryor joined Ordway as sergeants commanding the squads. Warfington, Floyd, and Pryor were not the only soldiers who had impressed the captains. Pryor was sick. In the detachment order recording the selections, Clark wrote, During the indisposition of Sergeant Pryor, George Shannon is appointed, pro tempore, to discharge the said Pryor's duty in his squad. Since Shannon was not yet 20 years old, the youngest man in the party, that appointment was a genuine compliment. The permanent party was now in place. Besides the 22 men and 3 sergeants, it included Lewis and Clark, Clark's slave York, Driard, and Lewis's dog, Seaman. It was straining to get going. Every morning, the men looked across the Mississippi and saw the Missouri pouring into the main stream, so powerful its muddy waters drove clear across 3/4 of the width of the mighty Mississippi, the Missouri being the more powerful of the two. Clark also recorded, "I send to the Missouri's water for drinking water, it being much cooler than the Mississippi." In the evening, the men could watch the sun go down over the Missouri. Surely, as they sipped their whiskey ration at the end of the day, they stared at that river and talked about it and thought about it. They were not daunted by it. Rather, they were drawn to it. What adventures awaited, what sights they would see, they knew they couldn't even guess, which only made them all the more eager to get going, so they could find out. Sergeant Gass wrote in his journal that the local inhabitants had warned that the party was to pass through a country possessed by numerous, powerful, and warlike nations of savages of gigantic stature, fierce, treacherous, and cruel, and particularly hostile to white men. But, he insisted, the determined and resolute character of the men, and the confidence pervading all ranks, dispelled every emotion of fear. A week after the ceremony of enlistment, Ordway wrote his parents. He expressed determination and confidence. "We are to ascend the Missouri River with a boat as far as it is navigable, and then to go by land to the Western Ocean, if nothing prevents, etc. This party consists of 25 picked men of the army and country, and I am so happy as to be one of them picked men. We are to start in 10 days, April 18th, up the Missouri River. We expect to be gone 18 months or 2 years. We are to receive a great reward for this expedition when we return." Ordway said he would be drawing $15 per month in pay and would receive a bonus of 400 acres of prime land. Then he reported what may have been just another soldier's rumor or an expectation encouraged by the captains. Whichever it was, it spoke to the spirit of the men and their captains. "If we make great discoveries as we expect, the United States has promised to make us great rewards more than we are promised, etc." Chapter 11. Ready to Depart. April to May 21st, 1804. As the April sun grew warmer, the banks of the Mississippi exploded into color. Green gold, nature's first hue, predominated early in the month, but it had serious competition. The captains noted spicewood in full bloom on April 1st, along with the white dogtooth violet and the mayapple. On the 5th, the buds of the peach, apple, and cherry trees, imported by the pioneers, appeared. By the 17th, they were in full bloom. Osage apple and Chickasaw plum were in flower, along with the violet, the dove's foot, and the cowslip. It was gorgeous weather, with afternoon temperatures climbing into the 60s and, by the last week of the month, into the low 70s. But on the 26th, a frost killed fruit at Cahokia. St. Louis escaped without damage. That afternoon, the temperature was up to 66. "Let's go," one can almost hear the men of the Corps of Discovery crying out to the captains. "Let's go, for God's sake." Lewis decided, no, not yet. Sometime between April 8th, when Sergeant Ordway wrote that the expedition would be off on April 18th, and mid-April, Lewis concluded that he needed far more in the way of provisions, and he needed more time to round them up. And Lewis needed time to arrange for the Osage chief's journey to Washington. He put departure day, D-Day, back a month. At 7 o'clock a.m. on Saturday, April 7th, Lewis and Clark set out in a canoe, with York and a private to paddle them, for St. Louis. They arrived at 10:30. Captain Stoddard greeted them and made them his guests. At his quarters, Lewis and Clark dressed, then went to a dinner and ball. Stoddard was the host. He had invited some 50 gentlemen of the city to thank them for their support and the courtesies shown to him. The ball lasted until 9 o'clock a.m. Sunday. No business today, Clark wrote in his journal on Sunday evening. On Monday, Clark returned to Wood River while Lewis began buying. Flags, mosquito nets, shirts, food, liquor, Indian trade goods. Among other things he bought and had shipped to Wood River, where it was repacked for the expedition, 4,175 complete rations at 14 cents each, 5,555 rations of flour at 4 cents each, 100 gallons of whiskey at $1.28 each, 20 gallons of whiskey at $1 each, 4,000 rations of salt pork at 4 cents each, plus ground corn and much more. Clark sent Lewis his shopping list, nails for hinges, 200 cent, Lewis noted on the list, red oil paint for the lockers, not to be had, Lewis noted, red and blue ribbon, cent, and so forth. On May 2nd, Lewis wrote Clark to report that the Osage party would set out in about 10 days, and to ask Clark to send to him in St. Louis the specimens of salt which you will find in my writing desk, on the shelves where our books are, or in the drawer of the instrument case. The invitation to rummage through Lewis's writing desk spoke to the absolute trust between the two men, and the sentence also gives a tiny glimpse into what their quarters at Wood River were like. Sunday, May 6th, was a grand day for Captain Clark, a horrible one for Captain Lewis. At Wood River, several of the settlers came in to challenge the soldiers to a shooting match. Of the challengers, Clark wrote with some satisfaction, all get beat and lose their money. In St. Louis, Lewis was frustrated because there were no more kegs to be had. He had bought out the entire stock. He was furious because Manuel Lisa had evidently not gotten enough of Lewis's business to satisfy him, and had therefore sent a petition to the authorities protesting Lewis's high-handedness and other shortcomings. On May 6th, Lewis wrote Clark about Lisa's actions and his reaction. He let it all out. Damn Manuel, Lewis exploded. And triply damn Mr. B., Francis Benoit, Lisa's partner. They give me more vexation and trouble than their lives are worth. I have dealt very plainly with these gentlemen. In short, I have come to an open rupture with them. I think them both great scoundrels, and they have given me abundant proofs of their unfriendly dispositions towards our government and its measures. His blood was up. These gentlemen, he wrote, then stopped, crossed it out, and continued, these puppies are not unacquainted with my opinions. Strange indeed that men to appearance in their senses will manifest such strong assumptions of insanity as to be whetting knives to cut their own throats. Lewis had reason to contemplate cutting his own throat. He had been forced to begin this letter with an awful piece of news. I send you herewith enclosed your commission accompanied by the Secretary of War's letter. It is not such as I wished or had reason to expect, but so it is. A further explanation when I join you. It was a lieutenant's commission, not a captain's, as Lewis had promised. Lewis was mortified and apparently helpless. His heart had sunk as he read Dearborn's reply to his letter of February 10th, asking about Clark's commission. Dated March 26th, Dearborn's letter began, "The peculiar situation, circumstances, and organization of the Corps of Engineers is such as would render the appointment of Mr. Clark a captain in that corps improper." The best Dearborn could do for Clark was a commission as a lieutenant in the Corps of Artillerists, which he enclosed. Clark's military grade would have no effect on his compensation for the expedition, Dearborn said, meaning Clark would still be paid as a captain. On March 24th, Dearborn had sent a list of nominations to Jefferson, including Clark's as a lieutenant in the artillery. That afternoon, Jefferson had endorsed the list and sent it on to the Senate for confirmation, which was done on March 26th. In a shifty little bureaucratic maneuver, Dearborn managed to make a bad situation worse. He dated Clark's commission as of the day he signed it, March 26, 1804. That hurt Clark on the seniority list and denied his service from the day he enlisted, and even denied his service from mid-October 1803 to March 26, 1804. As far as is known, Jefferson made no protest. Whether because he failed to notice or because he approved Dearborn's decision cannot be said. It had always been clear that if Clark turned down Lewis's invitation and Moses Hook took his place, it would be as a lieutenant and he would be clearly second in command, but that if Clark joined up, it would be as a captain and a co-commander. Jefferson knew that, and reports sent to him from St. Louis and Wood River also made it clear that Lewis and Clark had been functioning as co-commanders. It may be that Jefferson wanted Lewis in sole command. Perhaps he reasoned that in such a long voyage, it was inevitable that the two leaders would disagree, perhaps sharply enough to paralyze the command, or even worse, to divide the Corps of Discovery into hostile factions. Whatever Jefferson's intentions, Dearborn's action gave Lewis an opportunity to take sole command. But he felt not the slightest temptation to take advantage of the situation. He immediately wrote Clark, "I think it will be best to let none of our party or any other persons know anything about the grade. You will observe that the grade has no effect upon your compensation, which by God shall be equal to my own." For the next 7 years, only Dearborn, Jefferson, a clerk or two in the War Department, and Meriwether Lewis and William Clark knew that, as far as the Army was concerned, Captain Lewis was in command of the Corps of Discovery, with Lieutenant Clark as his second in command. For the men of the expedition, it was Captains Clark and Lewis, co-commanders. That was all that counted. Whether Clark ever talked to Lewis about the matter is unknown. In 1811, when Nicholas Biddle was editing the journals for publication, he asked Clark to explain the exact relation between the two officers. "Equal in every point of view," Clark wrote in reply. He said his feeling on learning that the promised captain's commission would not be forthcoming was as might be expected. But Lewis's stratagem satisfied him, and since "I wished the expedition success," I proceeded. He told Biddle that in the published journals he wished to be placed "on equal footing with Captain Lewis in every point of view, without exposing anything or even mentioning the commission at all." Clark confessed to Biddle, "I did not think myself very well treated," but said he had never mentioned the case to anyone, not even Jefferson or Dearborn. He instructed Biddle to keep the whole thing to himself. On another appointment matter, Lewis was successful. Jefferson had just taken the lead in founding the United States Military Academy at West Point. Lewis suggested using the academy as part of the effort to win over to the American side the French businessmen in the purchased territory. As historian Theodore Crackle puts it, Lewis's plan was simple. The sons of the area's leading citizens should be made cadets and sent to West Point. What better way to bind these families to the new nation and to the Jefferson administration? Dearborn and Jefferson accepted without hesitation. In April, Lewis and Stoddard recommended some young men for appointment to West Point, including Charles Gratiot and two sons of Auguste Chouteau. One of these, Lorimier, was half Indian. Stoddard would not go along with the recommendation for Lorimier because "he exhibited too much of the Indian in his color. This circumstance may make his situation among the cadets at the school rather disagreeable." Lewis stuck with the recommendation, and all three got their appointments. Three others were added later. Of the six, five graduated and got commissions, including young Lorimier, who served 3 years and won two promotions. In St. Louis, in the first week of May 1804, there were difficulties and postponements connected to the Osage chief's trip. In Wood River, Clark was having a hard time holding the young lions in. During the day, they were packing, unpacking, repacking, as Clark experimented with various possibilities. At night, too many of them got drunk and brought on Clark's displeasure, but not much more, because he recognized the cause of the problem and felt it would solve itself once they were underway. On May 7th, Clark loaded the keelboat. The following day, he and 20 oarsmen took it for a ride in the Mississippi to check its balance. Back on shore, Clark shifted more gear to the stern. On May 11th, Driard brought to camp seven voyagers who had been recruited in the St. Louis area with help from the Chouteaus. On Sunday, May 13th, Clark sent a message to Lewis in St. Louis. All was ready. The boat and pirogues were loaded. The boat would have 22 privates to row her, along with the three sergeants. One canoe would be paddled by six soldiers with Corporal Worthington. The other canoe would be paddled by eight French voyagers who would be returning with Worthington's group. The craft were complete with sails, etc., etc., men complete with powder cartridges and 100 balls each, all in health and readiness to set out. They had everything needed, they hoped. Clark entered an ominous note, saying they had enough of the necessary stores, as we thought ourselves authorized to procure. Not what the captains thought was needed, only what was authorized. In fact, Clark bluntly declared in his journal that the expedition did not have as many stores as I think necessary for the multitude of Indians through which we must pass on our road across the continent, etc. Nevertheless, the next morning, May 14th, Clark wrote in his journal, "Fixing for a start." That afternoon he set off at 4 o'clock, under a gentle breeze, and made 4 miles up the Missouri. He camped on an island. He described the men as being in high spirits, and said they were robust young backwoodsmen of character, healthy, hardy young men, recommended. The next day he set out for St. Charles, on the north bank of the Missouri, where he would shift the load again, having found that in the Missouri the concealed timber, either embedded in the river bottom or floating downstream almost completely submerged, was difficult to avoid and must be bumped into by the bow, rather than letting the bow ride up on the obstacles. That meant getting more goods in the bow, fewer in the stern. On May 16th, the expedition pulled into St. Charles, there to reload and wait for Captain Lewis to come up. Lewis was busy with the Osage party and with making arrangements for Captain Stoddard to act as his agent in St. Louis until he returned. On May 16th, he signed an authorization that gave Stoddard power to act in his behalf to draw bills of exchange on the Secretary of War to any amount which the nature of the service may in your judgment and at your discretion be deemed necessary. More specifically, Lewis declared that Indians would soon be arriving in St. Louis from upriver. He intended to select the delegations and start them on their way to Washington, where they would meet their new father. Lewis told Stoddard to spare no reasonable expense in getting these trans-Mississippi Indians to Washington, and see to their comfort and protection, especially if they were Sioux, the most numerous and warlike tribe on the Missouri, and one Lewis especially wanted to impress. Further, Stoddard should pay the French voyagers when they returned to St. Louis. And if anyone showed up in St. Louis with a chit from Lewis, Stoddard should pay in cash and notify the Secretary of War. Any letters arriving for Lewis, from whatever quarter they may come, should be sent to Jefferson, who would hold them. Over the following couple of days, Lewis made last-minute preparations for Chouteau's and the Osage chief's trip to Washington. He prepared a package for Chouteau to carry to Jefferson, including mineral specimens, a horned lizard, a chart of the Mississippi from St. Louis to New Orleans, and a map of Upper Louisiana done by Clark and Lewis, based on the Evans map and on what they had heard from French boatmen around St. Louis. This map has been identified by Donald Jackson as the first cartographic product of the expedition. On May 19th, Chouteau's party set off for Washington. At noon on May 20th, Lewis set off by horseback for St. Charles, accompanied by Stoddard, two of his lieutenants, Auguste Chouteau, Charles Gratiot, and a dozen or more of the substantial inhabitants of St. Louis. Lewis made a journal entry about the trip, almost the only one he wrote between November 1803 and April 1805. He noted, "The first 5 miles of our route laid through a beautiful high level and fertile prairie which encircles the town of St. Louis." At 1:30 p.m., a violent thunderstorm forced the party to take shelter in a little cabin. The men remained an hour and a half, and regaled ourselves with a cold collation which we had taken the precaution to bring with us from St. Louis. After the picnic, the rain continued. Impatient, Lewis said to hell with it and started off for St. Charles. Most of his companions accompanied him. They arrived at 6:30 and joined Captain Clark, found the party in good health and spirits. After a supper with the local officials, Lewis retired early to spend the night on the boat. In the morning, Clark said some of the men, 20 in all, wished to attend a final mass, and he had some rearrangements to make in the packing, so it would be mid-afternoon before the party could set off. Lewis took a look around St. Charles. Founded in 1769, it was a village of some 100 families living in homes Lewis described as small and but illy constructed. It had a chapel and a priest and about 450 inhabitants, overwhelmingly French Canadians. Not an inconsiderable proportion of them, Lewis noted, can boast a small dash of the pure blood of the Aborigines of America. Lewis hired two half-breeds, Pierre Peter Cruzat and Francis Labiche. Cruzat, son of a French father and an Omaha mother, was skilled in the sign language and spoke Omaha. Labiche spoke several native tongues. Lewis attached them to the permanent party after swearing them in as privates in the U.S. Army, a sure sign of his high approval of the two men. Clark had characterized the people of St. Charles as poor, polite, and harmonious. Lewis had a harsher judgment. He found them miserably poor, illiterate, and when at home, excessively lazy. Still, he found qualities to admire. They are polite, hospitable, and by no means deficient in point of natural genius. They live in a perfect state of harmony among each other. He regretted the influence of the Roman Catholic priest among them, a typical Virginia planter's prejudice, and regretted, too, that the men regarded the cultivation of the soil as a degrading occupation. To support their families, the men either undertook hunting trips to collect furs or hired themselves out as voyagers to paddle traders up the Missouri, the Osage, and other rivers. They were gone from 6 to 18 months at a time. Perhaps looking ahead to what faced him, Lewis said that the voyagers were always subjected to severe and incessant labor, exposed to the ferocity of the lawless savages, the vicissitudes of weather and climate, and dependent on chance or accident alone for food, raiment, or relief in the event of malady. Lewis had brought to Clark a letter from Clark's brother-in-law, William Croghan, which carried the welcome news that George Rogers Clark had revived from an illness that his family had feared would prove fatal. Just before setting out, Clark replied, giving the letter to Stoddard to take to St. Louis and post. He thanked Croghan for the news, which relieved him much, expressed the hope that he would be back in Clarksville in 2 years, and said, "I think it more than probable that Captain Lewis or myself will return by sea, the other by the same route we proceed." He concluded with a description of the rain, thunder, and lightning of the previous 3 days, and admitted that it "discommodes me a little in sitting out." Discommoded or not, at 3:30 p.m., to the cheers of a crowd on the bank, the expedition set out. Captain Stoddard was there. A couple of weeks later, he reported to Dearborn that, as Lewis and his party had begun the ascent of the Missouri, in the boat and two pirogues, "all of them were deeply laden and well manned. His men possess great resolution, and they are in the best health and spirits." As the keelboat turned her bow into the stream, Lewis and his party cut themselves off from civilization. There would be no more incoming letters, no orders, no commissions, no fresh supplies, no reinforcements, nothing reaching them until they returned. The captains expected to be gone 2 years, perhaps more. In all that time, in whatever lay ahead of them, whatever decisions had to be made, they would receive no guidance from their superiors. This was an independent command, such as the U.S. Army had not previously seen and never would again. Lewis and Clark were as free as Columbus, Magellan, or Cook to make their mark on the sole basis of their own judgments and abilities. Their first afternoon together on the Missouri, they made 3.25 miles. They camped that night on the head of an island on the starboard side. Spring storms continued and a hard rain lasted through the night. At 6 o'clock a.m., May 22nd, they were on their way. Chapter 12. Up the Missouri. May to July, 1804. The current ran at 5 miles per hour usually, but it sped up when it encountered encroaching bluffs, islands, sandbars, and narrow channels. The level was springtime high, almost flood stage. Incredible to behold were the obstacles, whole trees, huge trees, oaks and maples and cottonwoods, that had been uprooted when a bank caved in, hundreds of large and thousands of smaller branches, sawyers, trees whose roots were stuck on the bottom and whose limbs sawed back and forth in the current, often out of sight, great piles of driftwood clumped together, racing downriver, threatening to tear holes in the sides of the boat, innumerable sandbars, always shifting, swirls and whirlpools beyond counting. This was worse than the Mississippi. How in the world did they move that bulky boat, overladen in the bow, against the full force and power of the Missouri? Donald Jackson gives us a vivid description. A keelboat was a useful but ungainly craft. Loaded with 10 or 20 tons of cargo, and it was a faithful, wallowing drudge. Arm it with a swivel gun, set a guard with firearms at the gunwales, and it became a little warship. Navigating it downstream was easy if you kept an eye out for submerged logs, but going upstream there was no ideal way to keep it moving. If the wind was fair, you ran up a sail. When the wind failed, you broke out the iron-pointed setting poles and started pushing. If the bottom was deep enough, you could row. If the current was too swift for rowing, you could bend a 40-fathom length of cordling cable to the mast and put the crew ashore to haul on the line. Failing all this, you could tie up to the bank and wait for the wind to rise and blow fair. Despite everything, they made good time, generally, and if the wind was astern, they made excellent time, once or twice 20 miles in a day. But when the wind wasn't astern, it required absolute vigilance and complete concentration by the captains and the sergeants, and total physical commitment from the men to make every mile. The labor of the men was incredible, whether pulling at the oars or pushing against their setting poles as they walked on top of the lockers from bow to stern. For Worthington's party in the white pirogue, and for the voyagers in the red pirogue, it was somewhat easier. Their craft were lighter and rode higher in the water. They were more maneuverable, so it was easier to turn away from danger. On the keelboat, to help dodge obstacles, the crew had to rush to one side or the other again and again. In the pirogues, all they had to do was lean. The privates on the keelboat were tough, alert, quick. On June 16th, Clark reported a typical incident. Sand collecting, etc., forming bars and bars, washing away. The boat struck and turned. She was near oversetting. We saved her by some extraordinary exertions of our party, who are ever ready to encounter any fatigue for the promotion of the enterprise. On June 1st, the party reached the Osage River and made camp on the point on the left side. The captains ordered all the trees in the area cut down so that they could make observations and stayed there through the next 2 days. They spent hours observing the time and distance from the sun to the nearest limb of the early morning sliver of a moon. Between 6:22 and 8:28 a.m., they recorded 2 sets of 3 figures each, a total of 36 times, or about 1 every 3 minutes. When the expedition was underway, Clark was more often on the keelboat, Lewis on shore, because Clark was the better waterman, Lewis the better scientist. More skilled in zoology than in botany, according to Jefferson, but good at both. Lewis took long, solitary walks, collecting specimens, animal and plant, noting the physical characteristics of the land, judging the fertility of the soil, the presence of springs of good water, likely sites for homesteads, trading posts, and fortifications. Alas, none of his notes for the spring and summer of 1804 are known to exist. It makes a terrible gap in the records. His notes would have expressed his first reactions to the biomass west of the Mississippi. This was hardly unknown territory. By 1804, the lower reaches of the Missouri had been much traveled. The creeks, islands, and prominent landforms all had names, mainly French. An accurate map existed through the mouth of the Kansas up to the entry of the Platte, and a pretty good map of the country from the Platte to the Mandan villages. But for Lewis, it was all new, and he was seeing it with different eyes. Up to the mouth of the Kansas, most of the flora and fauna were known to science. But there was more than enough of the new to keep Lewis happily busy, collecting and describing and preserving. After the hours at his instruments, squinting at the sky, calling out numbers for Clark to record, the hours he got to spend tramping around the prairie on the high ground up from the valley, doing what botanists like to do best, discovering new species, were surely welcome. But we can't catch his joy and wonder through his own words because we don't have his notes, or any journal entry, even though in detachment orders that Lewis wrote and he and Clark signed and proclaimed on May 26th, Lewis ordered the sergeants, in addition to all other duties, to keep a separate journal from day to day of all passing occurrences and such other observations on the country, etc., as shall appear to them worthy of notice. It seems impossible that he could have issued such orders and not kept a daily journal himself, but if he did, we don't have it. Thus, as the keel boat makes its way west across the present state of Missouri, then turns north at the mouth of the Kansas toward the Platte and on into the Dakotas, we see Lewis only through the eyes of other men, principally William Clark. Clark was a great writer about events in which he participated, and described the country he was passing through with a lovely lyric quality, but he could be disappointingly terse when writing about an event he had not seen with his own eyes. Thus, on the second day of the journey, May 23rd, he wrote, "Captain Lewis ascended the hill which has peninsulas projecting in ragged points to the river, and was near falling from a peninsula of rocks 300 feet, he caught at 20 foot. Saved himself by the assistance of his knife." Surely Lewis told Clark more than Clark recorded about such a life-threatening incident. As soldiers who either learned lessons or died, they had a need to talk over incidents that threatened the expedition. They had to avoid unnecessary risks. So Lewis must have told Clark in some detail how he came to fall and how he saved himself, but this didn't make it into Clark's journal entry. There is another tantalizing item. The next day, the expedition passed Boone Settlement. The village consisted of a colony of Kentuckians led by Daniel Boone, who had settled there in 1799 on a grant of land from the Spanish government. The man who had blazed the way into Kentucky was creating a farmstead for his family on the river. Lewis and Clark went ashore. The settlers flocked around them. The men bought corn and butter. Then they were off. Did Lewis and Clark meet Daniel Boone? Did they shake his hand? Did he wish them luck, offer advice, or a drink? Did he pass the torch? Lewis and Clark meeting Daniel Boone sounds like a Charlie Russell painting, or a marvelous scene for a novel. But had he met Boone, surely Clark would have written about it. And there is no known Lewis entry for the day. The next day, May 25th, the expedition passed La Charrette, the last settlement of whites on the river. French and American settlers had lived there for 4 or 5 years. Daniel Boone would move there in 1805. The site is gone now, washed away by the river. Clark recorded, "The people at this village is poor, houses small. They sent us milk and eggs to eat." The main Lewis document available for this period is his May 26 detachment orders. It established the routine and serves as a reminder that this was much more than a bunch of the guys out on an exploring and collecting expedition. This was a military expedition into hostile territory. From Jefferson's point of view, the captains were on an expedition to explore newly acquired territory, to find the water route to the Pacific, to extend commerce, to collect specimens for science, and to establish an American claim on the Oregon country. From the point of view of the various Indian tribes, the keel boat carried uninvited strangers into their midst and their land. The United States had bought Louisiana from Napoleon, but not the loyalty or alliance or subservience of the people who lived in Louisiana. For Lewis and Clark, every strange Indian tribe encountered had to be considered belligerent until it proved otherwise. The Indians, they hoped, would be willing to talk and trade, but it would be the Indians' choice. They might decide to fight. Certainly they would be tempted. The expedition's arsenal was by far the biggest ever brought to the Missouri country, and any tribe able to take possession of it would dominate the region, no matter what the Louisiana Purchase said, for a long time to come. The last thing Lewis wanted was an Indian fight. He was prepared, and was under orders, to do everything possible to avoid one. The best way to avoid a fight was to make sure one never got started, which meant in the first instance making certain that the expedition was never caught by surprise. A camp of sleeping men with weapons carelessly scattered around could well tempt a roving band of Indians into an attack. A well-regulated camp, with guards posted and calling out challenges, would not. Instead of a fight, there would be a talk, which was what Lewis wanted most of all, because he believed the United States could bring more and better trade goods to the Missouri country from St. Louis than the British could bring down from Canada. Given a chance, Americans would win the fur trade. To prevent surprise, Lewis's detachment orders of May 26th stressed alertness. The sergeant of the guard had as part of his duty posting sentinels and ensuring the security of the camp. These were clear, direct orders with no words wasted but all possibilities covered, and they signified that the expedition was now in a war zone and might be attacked at any time. To add to nighttime security, the expedition camped on islands whenever feasible. There were daily inspections of the rifles, the blunderbusses, and the cannon to be certain they were ready for action. Lewis's May 26th order provides a series of images of life on the keelboat. He divided the permanent party into three squads, or messes, which, among other things, would cook and eat together. Each evening, upon landing, Sergeant Ordway would hand out to each mess a day's provisions. It would be cooked at once, and a portion reserved for the following day. No cooking was allowed during the day. The regular ration was hominy and lard on one day, salt pork and flour the next, and cornmeal and pork the following day. Eating hominy and lard cold on the day after it was cooked must have made fresh meat welcome. To provide it, Driard and two or three companions and two horses acquired in St. Charles went out every day to hunt. When they brought in deer or bear, no lard or pork was to be issued. From the third day of the expedition on, Lewis was conserving rations. Lewis's detachment order was exact about the responsibilities of the sergeants on the boat as it moved upstream. One sergeant was stationed at the helm, another midships, and the third in the bow. The sergeant at the helm steered, saw to the baggage on the quarterdeck, and attended the compass. The sergeant midships commanded the guard, managed the sails, saw that the men at the oars did their duty, and kept a good lookout for the mouths of all rivers, creeks, islands, and other remarkable places. He also measured out the whiskey ration and served as the sergeant of the guard at night. The sergeant at the bow was charged to keep a good lookout and to report all pirogues or other craft in the river and all hunting camps or parties of Indians. Two of the privates had specified duty. They were Labiche and Crusat, the mixed bloods who had joined up in St. Charles. They had been up the Missouri before and were the best rivermen in the enlisted ranks. Lewis ordered that they man the larboard bow oar alternately, and the one not engaged at the oar will attend as the bowsman, and when the attention of both these persons is necessary at the bow, their oar